everyone, and welcome back to Slapcast. This is another episode of our coverage of the 2022-23 season. I'm your host, Gage, as usual, and we are here immediately after my afternoon nap on this lovely Sunday afternoon, which is a synonym, of course, for the Carabao Cup final that just happened between Man United and Newcastle. It was an absolute schnoozer. We will talk about it, albeit briefly, after we conclude with our introductory proceedings. I must, of course, introduce to you all those who are joining me today, which starts with Reese. Hello, Reese.
Hello.
Second up, we have Ethan. Hello, Ethan.
Hello, Gage. Nice Sunday. Nice Sunday going on.
It is a nice Sunday. It's actually nice outside, which is a good start.
Rare.
But yeah. And we are joined as well by Josh. Josh, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm feeling good, actually. Feeling nice. Spurs have actually beaten Chelsea for the first time in 500,000 centuries. So I feel relatively upbeat.
Today. Is it only five? Is it 5 years or is it like four and a half since the last time?
Four and a half.
Well, but at least it's not five.
Okay.
I'm just.
At least it's not 13 years since we won it, or 15 years since we won a trophy. It's only 14.
Could be worse.
Could be 67 if you're Newcastle. All right.
Wow.
What is the question of the day, Josh?
So off cup for no reason. So I'm drinking a Gatorade this afternoon. So I'm not going to limit it to just Gatorade because I know some people here like Powerade significantly more. What is your favorite normal sports drink flavor? Body Armor's not included because they get actual like real fruit flavors and not orange.
I'll give you a Gatorade and a Powerade.
Me too.
Okay.
I've got two answers for Powerade. I'm going to give you three things. Okay. Normally, red Powerade, fruit punch Powerade. Mm-hmm. It's just classic. I do like the blue Powerade from McDonald's though. They have like a specific recipe. Sometimes they really mess it up and it's terrible. Like the other day, it was just straight syrup and it was the most disgusting thing I've ever had. But normally it's pretty good.
So I'm going to interrupt real quick. So I've read why all their Coke products are so much better. It's because the syrup doesn't get delivered in bags like most places. It gets delivered to McDonald's in these giant aluminum like containers. So, like, there's no, like, bag flavor to it, so it just tastes better.
Bag flavor?
I knew the bag flavor. It was slightly different. I didn't know what, though.
Yeah, so, like, it stays more carbonated because, like, the metal helps. I think it helps something with the gases. I'm not sure what.
Gatorade, I'm a lime. I'm a lime enjoyer.
The cucumber lime or the
lime?
No,
I hate the cucumber one.
Oh, the cucumber lime.
The yellow one.
Gosh, back at it again with another diabolic taste.
I hate the cucumber one. It tastes terrible.
It's so good.
No.
I think it's fine. I'm just not the huge.
I also think it's fine, but
it's not my favorite. I think it's good. It's also really good with tequila in it.
Anything's good with tequila in it if you drink it for long enough. That's
not true. If
you drink it for long enough, it is true.
I'll give both answers, Powerade and Gatorade too. So I'm a big orange fan in terms of Power or Gatorade. I just like the orange one, and I know not a lot of people do. For Powerade, this might be a surprise. I love the grape Powerade. Really? I know the grape. Yeah, I know grape is a very like borderline subject for a lot of people because sometimes it's just like too grapey, or some people say it just tastes like purple. And not like grape, but I love the grape Powerade.
I'm a grape enjoyer. I don't mind some grape flavor. I think sometimes you get certain things. I don't think this about Powerade, but you do get certain things that taste a little bit like Sudafed.
Yeah.
Like you start getting cough syrupy.
I love the grape for the walk.
The walkie walkie slush, of course. I think I don't really have an answer for Powerade because I don't drink Powerade that enough to really know. I guess out of the two flavors of Powerade that I can think of right now, I guess the blue one is probably my favorite, but I don't even know what that flavor is called.
Blueberry.
Isn't there like mountain
blast or something like
mountain
that?
Mountain berry or something like that.
Yeah. I'm just, for whatever reason, just don't come across Powerade very often. Gatorade, on the other hand, I'm a clear enjoyer. The clear Gatorade I think it's rare now. Like, it used to be not as rare, but I think it's called like Glacier Berry or something like that.
It's Glacier Cherry.
Yes.
Glacier Cherry. Yeah. It is crazy. It's definitely
clear.
Is
one of the ones where this might be weird. I wouldn't say I prefer it like this, but like normally in all cases, I want my Gatorade cold, but I'm just like imagining a scenario where I've just been like running a bunch. I'm outside. I'm handed a warm Glacier Cherry Gatorade and it's like kind of hidden.
This is going to sound gross, but when I played baseball, I would sometimes forget my drinks in my bag. So I would just play. I would grab what was ever in my bag.
That's what I'm saying. The like week old warm Glacier Cherry goes crazy.
Literally sipping like a 10-year-old after running outside.
I'm not saying I prefer it like that, but it is like a little.
It's an experience. Yeah.
Okay. That's kind of like. It's kind of like drinking out of a garden hose or something.
What is up with the garden hose? Come on. Why does it taste so good?
It's all those trace metals, man.
Oh, I love it. Oh,
there's dangerous levels of like lead and zinc in there. And
I love lead.
I love lead.
Don't take a still frame of that. That's going on the thumbnail. Josh, I don't think you ever actually answered.
No, I haven't.
If you say cucumber, I'm going to walk out.
It's not. That one's not my favorite. My dad likes it, and that's like one of the like three flavors he got.
Not Dave.
That's just a dad. It's a dad thing. My dad loves that too.
My dad thought it was stupid at first. He was like, why do I need to drink a cucumber? And I was like, it's good. It's not amazing, but it's good. And he was like, fine, I'll try it. And he was like, that's really good. And yeah, just normal. Dave thinks. And he, yeah. So anyway, not my favorite. I will say, like, I think Reese said, like, Powerade can almost taste like Sudafed. I think the majority of Powerade flavors taste like Sudafed. I'm going to go with Powerade Zero Grape because I think it makes it taste better. Not because, like, I think it's better for you because it's no shot.
Yeah, you think you're better than me?
Yes. I just think like it makes it taste less like it's less thick. That's the one thing I have with Powerade is it just kind of tastes thick when I'm drinking it.
You don't like thickness?
No, not particularly when I'm trying to drink something.
You like cucumber drink though.
Yeah, it's not thick.
Have y'all seen that clip on TikTok where it's like how the laws of physics really happened? And it's Sir Isaac Newton, and his quote is, I like them thick as fuck. And then it cuts to the other guy, and he's like, man, we can't write this down. And then it cuts back to Newton, and he has the Chad face, and he's like, the greater the mass, the greater the force of attraction, or something like that. So stupid.
That's actually
what
made
me think of that.
My Gatorade answer is the OG. It's the orange, and it's like for me, it's not even close. It's orange, and it's
is orange OG.
Yeah, is orange the OG?
I thought it is.
I thought it was the lime one.
Yeah, I thought it was the yellow, lemon. Like the yellow one.
I thought the orange was the OG.
Google.
I don't know. I mean, yeah, I love yellow.
Lock in answers.
Orange is very good. I think yellow is OG.
I think the yellow is OG.
I just typed, "What is the original Google flavor?"
We gotta know.
Although it could just be like. Red.
Oh, okay, lemon lime was the original, but red and orange were the first expansion flavors.
Yeah, what I've seen is that the first Gatorade brand was Gatorade Thirst Quencher, which was produced in liquid and powder form under two flavors, lemon lime and orange. So there you go.
So they were both. Interesting.
But I will say, like, my go-to is Body Armor, like, 100% of the time. But every once in a while, I'm like, okay.
Body Armor had, like a Kobe drink, like an honor.
The strawberry
of,
grape
the black mamba
it
one.
Was really good.
Yeah.
Like, it was really I always good. Look at the nutritional info, and I'm like, oh, my God. I cannot have, like, anything sugar for, like, the next million years.
Sleeper Gatorade flavor, any of the flavors that come in the teat bottle?
The what?
You know what I'm talking?
Oh,
it's like you suckle on the teat.
Yeah. The teat of the gator.
The gator.
Something about having that just makes them all taste good.
I will say there's Body Armor Zero, which doesn't have any sugar, and it doesn't taste that different. Like I can't really taste much of a difference.
Yeah, and some of the flavors in it are really good. Like I'm drawing it, like the peach mango one.
Yeah, I think that's the best one.
They just dropped a cherry lime one, and I am a limeade sucker. And so that one is like my new go-to. I love that one. That one's insane.
Try it.
If you had said you were a sucker for limeade, I wouldn't have batted an eye, but you said you were a limeade sucker, which is heinously different for some reason. Okay. Let's quickly move on so that we don't get embroiled in this useless argument. Let's begin. Well, actually, let's begin with the game that just happened it did just happen. And Man United have won their first trophy since the Europa League under Mourinho in 2017. True. So 3 years ago, or oh my God, what? 6 years ago? I don't know. I mean, the game itself, pretty boring affair. Not much going on for either side until Man U scored from a set piece through Casemiro. And then Rashford does what Rashford does and scored again, featuring some poor goalkeeping from Loris Karius.
Apparently it went down as a Botman own goal.
Did it? Okay. I mean, it was a pretty big deflection, so I'm not surprised by that. But
that
was still,
poor goalkeeping. I mean, he was already going down and then...
Yeah, that is true, actually. He was preparing for the actual Rashford shot, and then it took it over him.
Like, the fact that he even got a finger on it is kind of insane.
I had something else to say that was no doubt an incredibly strong comment, but it's gone. I don't remember what it was.
I saw a very interesting take about United that I actually really agree with, and it was basically saying that as of right now, part of the reason, because you kept mentioning that in the league, you feel like they are just beating random bottom half teams every week. And I think part of the, and Josh also mentioned that he felt some of it was like counterattacking, and we like were like kind of half and half, like we couldn't really decide if they were counterattacking or not. And I saw a take that was basically like United right now are like pretty good under Ten Hag, but they were so bad at the beginning of the season and previously that a lot of teams that would normally against like City or Arsenal or any other of the top six be sitting with a really low block are setting up with a higher block against United because they think they can get something from the game.
Mm-hmm.
And that could contribute to this like weird, unable to define counterattacking play that they're able to do because they just have a slightly higher block against them than some of these other teams do.
I could see that coming to fruition, yeah. I think the longer we go into the season, the less true that probably is because as teams start to realize that they're not actually a joke right now anymore, maybe that'll change. Although, that being said, I think it does generally take tactical trends and adjustments. I find that they're delayed about a year relative to a specific team. So, like, what I mean by that is think back to, like, the season Leicester won the league or, like, the season Conte's Chelsea won the league. Like they win the league because they have this one specific system that they use that teams aren't shutting down. And then the next season they get shut down. So I think tactical tweaks and adjustments usually take, I don't even remember where I was going with this point, but they are delayed around a year. So maybe next season, Ten Hag's United is going to have to make some more adjustments to survive as easily as they have done with this comfortable string of results now, if that makes any sense. I have no idea if that was coherent, but
it was. I think the biggest thing, if they want to, I think they're going to have to be able to figure out how to sustain possession. And I don't know.
Yeah.
I think they need someone to partner with Casemiro to make that actually work. Like, I think they need either a true holding midfielder to allow Casemiro to go box to box or get someone who is a better box-to-box than Casemiro is, which is kind of hard to think about, but allow him to just be the anchor in the midfield. But I don't know. That's like a summer problem. I think of one more good midfielder, not Fred, but is going to allow them to change their tactics a lot more.
I wonder how much Sabitzer is a thought on that regard, because obviously he's kind of a short-term experiment for right now, but they could obviously go back in for him in the summer if they feel like he's
true
matching up in that tactical perspective.
That maybe they'll bring Pogba.
He hasn't
back.
Really imagine. I honestly wouldn't be surprised
for $100 billion.
Yeah. I'm interested to see if and when Sabitzer actually starts regularly. I think with Eriksen being out long term, now's the time, really, if they're going to do that. But obviously, Fred has been playing well. Like, let's not discredit Fred for what he's been doing. Although I do agree that he needs to be replaced in the long term if they're going to be consistent challengers. But yeah, it's an interesting perspective for sure. A word about Newcastle. I mean, obviously, nobody would have expected them to be in this final, I don't think, especially not this early. And I mean, the Geordie support, as always, was brilliant. At the end of the game, they had all the flags out, and it looked really cool. Like around Wembley, they had the black and white flags going. Even though they're down 2-0, the support still absolutely through the roof for Newcastle. So,
yeah, the team just kind of seemed like they weren't ready to win a trophy yet. Like, give it another season or two.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I necessarily don't think Karius did a bad job. It's just Nick Pope is a different breed to Karius. And so the fact that they were missing him out, this game was...
Yeah. And he hasn't, like what they said before, he's like 4 days short of not playing a competitive game in 2 years, which largely I don't think is his fault. I think Liverpool just like freaked out after him having one bad game that season and just destroyed his career.
It was not one bad game.
Yeah, but it was like...
He wasn't nearly as bad as people make him out to be just because of what happened in the Champions League final.
He had like one.
There's a couple instances. Maybe it's different because there's one specific instance I can think of against Arsenal that season, which was the that crazy comeback game, the 3-3 one. Xhaka had a shot that kind of had a little bit of weird movement, but it was practically right at Karius.
Oh, I remember that. I think I remember being mad that he didn't save that. I'm pretty sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because were you, I think you were at my house watching that game, weren't you?
No, I was at my house. Yeah, I was watching that with my ex.
Randomly. Yeah, I knew she was there, but I thought it was at my house for some reason. Anyway. Oh, no, mine was the one where the Leicester 4-3 game where Lacazette scored and you like did a backflip off my couch because Josh had been shitting on you the whole season or the whole preseason.
Yeah.
Okay. Anyway,
he scored in like the first minute, didn't he?
Yeah, he did. I did want to mention actually someone that I've been a little bit perplexed by his continual, well, first of all, by his signing, and secondly, by his continued inclusion in the team. I thought Weghorst might have been man of the match today, at least in the first half. Second half was just not one of the like most garbage halves of football I've seen, because United were just shutting it down. But I thought Weghorst was really good, really great hold-up play. The ball through for Rashford's goal, obviously, was perfectly well-timed. Good combinations there. And then he almost had a goal of his own when he cut inside on his left and shot from distance. And Karius actually made a pretty good save in that regard. But
yeah, I think his primary role is definitely to just be a hold-up guy and feed the ball through for the wingers. But, I mean, when you have Rashford on one side and I don't think he's that good, but somebody who's very quick and Antony on the other side, it's definitely viable, right?
Yeah. Antony and or Sancho, whenever he actually makes an appearance, who I think is better. But yeah, let's leave United there. I think the key thing for both of these teams now is they're going to be a game behind or two, I think, in Newcastle's case now in the Premier League. So that's good. But the old adage, of course, is that you'd rather have points on the board, and especially given the fact that their fixtures are going to be more congested than everyone else's now because they've had to move another game. I think those are going to be two factors that they will have to keep in mind, obviously. And especially I'm really targeting that comment towards Newcastle because I think their squad is, they have a very good first 11, but a lot of their substitutes are still kind of that old Newcastle group, like your Jacob Murphys, your kind of I'm struggling to think of any other players other than Jacob Murphy, but he's the one that comes to mind. It's just that kind of level of Newcastle player, if you see what I mean. So I think fixture congestion will begin to play a huge role as we start to count down the days of the Premier League. So, all right, let's go on to some matches that did actually happen in the Premier League. Let's start, because I said I didn't want to forget this earlier, with the relegation stuff, because there were three matches this week that changed the landscape of the relegation zone quite a bit. But first of all, Leeds have finally hired a manager after all this time of not having a manager, and they've decided to go with Javi Gracia, the former Watford carousel man. I told Ethan this, which, I mean, I don't know. They've started off with a 1-0 win and a good performance, but against the worst team in the league, so take it with a grain of salt. Not Javi Garcia, Javi Gracia. Just trying to figure out where he managed last. I think it's the fast track to relegation. I don't know what you guys think about this appointment, but it stinks of relegation to me.
Last time he was at Watford was when they got relegated, right?
I have no idea because of how many managers they went through.
Yeah, you could probably say that he was sacked before they got relegated.
Well, I think that's true, but I think it was that season.
No, okay, so he kept them up 18-19 and took them to the FA Cup final where they lost 8-0 to Man City. And then he was sacked 2 weeks into the new season.
Oh.
So there you go.
Two weeks?
And then that's when they went down. Dude, Watford are a prank. They are not a real team, I swear. So since his tenure at Watford, he went to Valencia, where he was largely unsuccessful, from what I can gather. He was sacked in May when Valencia was in 14th place. So that's not the best result ever. Then he spent a season at Al Sadd. And since completing a season there, he has been out of work until receiving the job at Leeds United. So I think they're going to get relegated. This is just such an uninspiring, safe, bullshit appointment, in my opinion.
Yeah, I mean, obviously we can't know who all was available, right, and who all wanted to take the job, but it just does not bode well.
Yeah. And I mean, there isn't that many managers that are available in this time period, but you know, there, I feel like you could easily have found someone better than him. Cause like, I know a bunch of managers just got fired after the World Cup. So maybe one of them could have probably been a better shout.
You know, I told this to Ethan, Rebecca Lowe had a very interesting pick for who should be the new manager, or maybe she was talking about Southampton. I think it was Leeds though. She was talking about Leeds, and she said Frank Lampard, which at first I was like, what are you talking about? And then she was like, there's two scenarios. One, he does what he did at Everton when he came in and keeps him up. Or two, you get relegated and they bring him in to stay if you get relegated, because he did have success in the championship. And I was like, okay, that kind of makes sense. Obviously it didn't happen, but I think I probably would have preferred it over Javi Gracia.
Me too. And this reeks of a short-term appointment, because we were talking about this with Southampton too, who still don't have a manager, by the way, and saying that whenever they were linked with Jesse Marsh, which I think since our last show has now been debunked, or not debunked, but the talks have fallen apart. We were saying that, you know, they should bring him in with a view to staying up, but then if you don't stay up, make sure he stays on and build something in the championship and then try to come back up next season, which I think is what these teams need to be doing. And Javi Gracia, to me, is an appointment that does not say that. Like, to me, that's an appointment that he's going to get sacked if they go down, right? So I don't understand the appointment from any regard, really. But
did Southampton hire their assistant for the rest of the season? Or am I crazy?
Did they? I'm not sure.
I think they did after the Chelsea win.
I'm going to go look at that real quick. I totally believe you, but I just didn't see that. Ruben Saez is listed as their manager right now. That might be, yep. I'm sure that's what you're talking about.
Here's the tweet. They confirmed it like 2 days ago. He's appointed first team manager until the end of the season.
Really?
Now that also just reeks of relegation to me. Like,
yeah, honestly, I think I'd rather them appoint, like, because he's basically an interim. Obviously, he's not technically an interim, but he's somebody that they can very easily, you know, ask to step down and then hire somebody else in the case that they get relegated.
Yeah.
So, like, I'd rather that than Javi Gracia, because at least it has some plan of getting relegated.
True. How bizarre. And his managerial history, by the way, under-18s coach at Valencia in 2020, then nothing, then came in as caretaker manager at Southampton after being their assistant under both Nathan Jones and Ralf Hasenhüttl. And then now he's given the job. So I guess, I mean, I understand the principle. Like, Bournemouth did this too with after they sacked Eddie Howe. They just appointed Jason Tindall, and it didn't work. But I understand the sentiment. I guess you're right, Reese. I was going to argue with you, but I actually think you're right about preferring this to Javi Gracia because they're not committing to something short-termist.
Yeah. I mean, it's almost a little bit like they're just accepting relegation, because it's like, if he keeps them up, that's great, but it's not really expected. I mean, I don't think anybody's expecting them to keep him up. But yeah, if they get relegated, which they probably will, it's very easy to now just wait until more managers are available in the summer.
Okay, this might be a crazy take, but I'm just looking at their squad right now, and I actually don't think getting relegated is the worst thing ever for them. Like, I think obviously they want to stay in the Premier League first and foremost, and I'm not suggesting that they should ever want or try to get relegated, but looking at especially the signings that they've made, if you think about all of these young, unproven players who haven't had much time at senior level, they've got, and also these players that they brought in are not going to be people that are going to be kind of want aways if they get relegated, right? They don't have the pedigree to be able to ask away from the club if they get relegated.
Yeah.
So a lot of the players that they've signed in this Premier League season will go down with them and continue to play and develop in the Championship. Now, there will be people that leave. Obviously, I think if they go down, I think Ward-Prowse probably leaves. I think you're kind of like Kyle Walker-Peters probably leaves. Those kind of guys probably leave. But all of these young players that they've brought in will stay and have another season to develop and then maybe come back up ready, a new club. So maybe relegation isn't the worst thing in history for them. But I know, I can't remember who said they wanted to talk about West Ham, but go now.
Josh wanted to.
I think so. West Ham went stupid this weekend. Beat Forest 4-0 on Saturday, which I greatly like constrained. Like, the bottom of the half of the table is like already like super tight. Like, Palace is in 12th, and y'all are probably still pretty far out of it. But y'all are only
it's a few points.
Yeah, it's 6 points, and like Leicester were 3 points, and then so West Ham winning like drew themselves above Everton and I think Leeds as well this weekend. It's a 23 points. So it's really tight at the bottom, and West Ham like looked good, except it's Forest, so you don't really know if they actually look good. So it's a weird spot right now for the relegation battle. It's getting even tighter. When like last week it was like, okay, it's starting to like semi clear the waters, and now it's not.
Yeah, putting four past Nottingham Forest. I mean, I know Nottingham Forest are no like defensive like wall, but like West Ham have been struggling for goals. So being able to put four, and Danny Ings getting the brace.
Forest haven't really been pushovers this season either, though. I mean, they haven't been great by any stretch, but they've been defensively organized. I mean, I can't really remember any occasion where they've gotten absolutely smashed except by City, but then, you know, who hasn't been smashed by City a few times? So but like, this is the first result I can think of that actually says to me, okay, they might not be a very good team, especially against West Ham, who I witnessed last week firsthand are dreadful. So maybe Danny Ings getting some momentum, scoring some goals, the claret and blue man, as we were discussing last night, shows up to his third claret and blue club and is scoring goals again. So Fair play to him, and maybe that will be the key to them escaping relegation. I kind of think they're one of these teams that's too big to go down, you know. Yeah. Like I sort of feel that way about Everton too.
Yeah.
As much as I would love to see both of them get relegated, I just don't ever feel like it'll happen unless they like go bankrupt or something, which is actually a real possibility in both of their cases, I think. Then I can't really see it happening. But
I mean, Everton are back in the relegation zone because they did lose.
They did lose. Yeah, that was the other thing we were gonna we wanted to briefly touch on.
Other relegation stuff. Leeds. This is not to do with their relegation, but McKinney, Adams, and Aronson started together for the first time this weekend.
I saw a clip of some build-up play, and it was nasty.
Yeah. Who did they play this weekend?
Southampton.
Southampton.
They won, right?
Yeah.
Yep.
We were just talking about that.
I'm sorry. I didn't hear Leeds won. I was focused on the Everton loss. And I started
thinking about Everton. But that is exciting. I mean, it definitely gives me more of a reason to care about Leeds than I would have otherwise, which is a stupid thing to say because it's so obvious. But yeah, I'm thankful that they're playing together, because the chemistry at club level can only mean good things for the national team. So, and I'm interested to see if they can work as a trio, because we got this bill sold to us at the World Cup that they can't work together as a trio. And I'm interested to see if they actually can or not, because I've always been a little bit skeptical of Greg Berhalter just as a concept, but now we need to see if it can be done or not, and see if Berhalter is a fraud or not.
At least you're going to have to worry about qualifying for the World Cup this time.
Yeah, that is true. Okay, let's move on from relegation. Actually, let's talk briefly. We did this a couple weeks ago, and I can't remember who everyone picked, but is anyone wanting to change their relegation predictions?
I mean,
who do I even say?
My pick was definitely hate charge, just because I hate them. I said Everton, but now that they've hired Sean Dyche, I think it's definitely going to be Southampton and Bournemouth, but I'll probably give me a second.
I think, Reese, I think you and I both said Leeds, Bournemouth, Southampton, I'm pretty sure. I can't remember what Josh said, but
I will keep it like that.
Yeah, I'll concur with y'all.
I think I said Leeds, Everton, Southampton.
Someone said Wolves. I think
no, it might have been. You said Wolves, Josh.
Oh, yeah. Wolves down there. Leeds, Wolves, Southampton, I think. Or Everton, Wolves. One of those. I don't remember. Yeah, sure. I'll keep the same out. Okay.
Yeah, I'm gonna stick with Leeds, Bournemouth, Southampton. I think those will be the three that go down. Yeah. All right.
Wolves is a weird team.
Weirds is a Wolves team.
Sorry, I was. It's a lot of W's. We've been mentioning a lot of W's.
We have, dude. The Craig Dawson gambit.
I know. He's coming back to haunt me. No, but the Wolves are a weird team. I mean, just when you think that they've, like, you know, okay, they've got good players, a good manager, they're going to move back up in the table, but they're still down there. And they're not out of the contention to get relegated.
No, they're not. I do favor them to get better results over the course of the season than the three that I previously mentioned. And actually, I favor them to do better than West Ham and Everton as well. Mm-hmm. Just because I have more faith in their existing structure than I do that of Everton or West Ham. So,
yeah.
All right, Reese and Josh, let's talk about the slap showdown that occurred this weekend. Leicester playing host to Arsenal, which ended in a 1-0 result for the league leaders. I don't know where you guys want to start with this, because there's probably a few different things you could talk about. But
yeah, I don't know. Do you want to go first, Josh?
Sure. So I think this was not a matter, like, at least Gage talked about, like, we had a 0.01 XG, and I don't necessarily think that was us being bad. That was Arsenal just being really organized defensively and midfields, where, like, anytime we would get either sustained amount of possession or a counterattack, there would be two, one and a half to every one of our attackers going forward, and there was not a whole lot we could do about it. It was also, we were without Madison. He was sick this week, so we didn't play. But I think the big thing with the counterattacks is the first few times we tried to hold it up a little bit more. Real's midfield just beat us back because of how far back we were sitting, that we just could not build anything up. But then we didn't change that. We just kept slowing down on the wings and trying to hold the ball up, which just didn't work. And then like the last like 20 or 30 minutes, we actually like were attacking. We just could not get the final ball through. We looked like y'all did the first 20 minutes.
Yeah. Like, I'm very interested to know like possession for the first like 70-ish minutes based against like the last 20. Cause I texted you afterwards. I was like, y'all looked like an actual team the last couple minutes.
I think.
And y'all had like sustained possession. Yeah. But like, I checked. I felt like y'all had most of the possession towards the end of the game, and we still ended with almost 70-30 Arsenal.
Yeah.
Well, and like I really did feel like y'all had no possession, because like even with when y'all had a little bit of possession in the first half, you either turned it over, like consistently turned it over,
mm-hmm.
or had it on a counter and then, like you said, slowed it down based on, you know, pressure from our midfield players or, you know, whichever defender was there. Because our defenders played very well this game, which allowed us to just kind of regroup and be really good defensively.
Yeah, I think we were also really – we were almost as good defensively as y'all. Like, outside of a correct-ish VAR call, a not correct, no penalty, like, largely, like, defensively, we were really good on the day, but I think y'all just shut us down completely going forward. And also, like, we didn't really have any midfielder that like is comfortable with being a 10 or even an advanced 8. Like, Dewsbury Hall was box to box without a question. Madison was out, and then Pratt is okay. He's just kind of there most of the time. And then Ndidi, I feel like we would have done better if Tielemans had actually started, or if we had Mendy play the holding midfield role and allowed Ndidi to be a box-to-box with Dewsbury Hall. I think that would have fit the situation a little bit better. But I think it was just – we just didn't have enough. And I think Tete is just not I don't think he's trusting himself enough. I think he's trying to rely on everybody else making runs around him. I think he just needs to trust his footwork a little bit more, and I think he'll go leaps and bounds forward, because he had some great runs, but Iheanacho, whenever he slid to the right on the counterattacks, just wasn't able to find him, which was disappointing. Because there were a few runs where it was like, oh, if he could have just picked out – if Iheanacho would have picked out the pass, like, surely someone would have scored.
Yeah, no, definitely had a couple of chances. It was just, like – it just completely shut down in the end. There was just no – what's the word I'm looking for? No,
there's no pace going forward.
Yeah.
So, like, y'all's defensive structure and – our lack of pace going forward, I think, contributed a lot. I think, like, when we brought Vardy and Dako on, you could see that, like, it completely changed. And I don't know if that would have been, like, halftime substitution. I think that would have been much better, like, at 60 minutes, like, versus that late in the game. It just – we weren't able to change anything about it at that point, so.
Well, I think part of the reason it's that late is if it happens in, like, the 60th minute, at that point in the game, we're still trying to get another goal, so it's not going to be as much of us allowing y'all to get into the game as much. But at the point that they came on, it's 1-0 Arsenal. It's pretty much just game management time and just try and see the game out, which inherently allows y'all to see the ball more. So saving those substitutions till then, when you do have more possession, could be the thought process.
Yeah, but I also don't think that we don't need the pace whenever we're trying to break y'all down. I think we need the hold up play from Iheanacho. I would have rather had the pace of Dhaka or Vardy whenever we're trying to get a run in behind the four defenders, because y'all have a very fast defense just inherently.
Yeah.
You know, they're all tall and like have lengthy strides, so it's hard to get in behind. So whenever Iheanacho just is not going to beat them getting in behind, and that's kind of what we needed. I think if we would have put in Dhaka, I think about like 50 or 60 minutes, I think he probably would have scored, because we were getting a counterattack probably every like 2 to 3 minutes. And I think if we had a little bit more pace, it would have worked out a lot better.
Interestingly, our starting front three for this game was Martinelli, Trossard, and Saka. Mm-hmm. Which I think is partially tactical, partially just wanting to rest Nketiah, because, I mean, Nketiah is our only fit striker at the club right now. So he has been playing every single game since the World Cup without getting substituted. So I think part of that's wanting to rest him a bit. The other half, which, you know, I immediately, this is what I thought, I think it was fairly obvious, and then Arteta talked about it afterwards, was that when you have Martinelli and Trossard, who can both kind of play as a striker, but also both play as a left winger, you get this interesting fluid kind of thing where they're swapping around all the time, and it's just making a mess for defenders. And yeah, I mean, it kind of worked. I mean, Martinelli's the one who ended up getting the goal.
Well, they combined for the goal, actually.
They did combine for the goal, yeah. Cheeky little nutmeg assist from Trossard.
Yeah. I think Gaston did a great job of recovering. Castagna and Soutar did a great job of recovering whenever they did switch throughout the entire game. I think that's what kept y'all from getting that final third pass in for 70% of the game was they just did a great job of covering and switching, which I think is because Gaston is just generally fast because he was a wing back at Atalanta and for Belgium.
Yeah.
And Soutar is 6'6 and a mountain of a man. I also think the fluidity plays into Saka liking to play as an inverted winger more. So I think that also helps a lot. Like, I don't think it's ideal, but I don't think it's a bad option when you need to rotate people. When is Jesus supposed to be back? Is that
soon? Like a couple weeks, I think.
But I don't know. It's one of those. It's like, I'm not terribly upset by us losing. Like, yes, it was very like lackadaisical going forward and we could have changed things, but it's also top team of the league and we played really, really well defensively. And the defensive half of the midfield game, I think we played really, really well.
Yeah. I think it also shows how influential James Maddison actually is too, because as a creative force, like I know Spurs were awful against Leicester, so I'm not trying to draw a comparison, but he was at the heart of almost everything y'all did going forward against Spurs. Yeah. And I think it just shows how much of a difference he makes.
I agree.
I was really happy Martinelli was the one who got the goal, because I've had a little bit of criticism for him over the past couple of weeks. Nothing major, but just a few little nitpicks. And I think this will be huge for his confidence. Because mm-hmm. He has just kind of looked like he was lacking confidence. There's a couple of times where I'm like, I mean, I told Ethan, it was during the United game. I was like basically yelling at the TV, like, just take on the man, because he just looked scared mm-hmm. to take anyone on in a 1v1. And I think the goal will help him out, because that's like a huge part of his game. Again, Jorginho had a really good game. There was some stats that were really good. I forget them now, but it was like something like most forward passes and most recoveries or something. I don't remember exactly.
I think this might not be what you're talking about, but somewhere someone said or someone posted a stat that in his three appearances for Arsenal so far, he's made more progressive passes than he did for Chelsea all last season.
Yeah.
Or something like that. So,
yeah, I saw another tweet along the same lines. It was like, I can't believe Chelsea tried to convince us that Jorginho can't make forward passes. Because, I mean, he really – it's a slightly different thing from Partey. Because I think what Partey has is he just is very good at carrying the ball and moving the ball in tight spaces, which allows Odegaard to just kind of move to wherever he wants and then receive the ball. Whereas Jorginho is kind of like he's a quarterback in a sense, where, I mean, he had a pass in this game that was just like from our own half, totally split Leicester's defense to Saka. And I mean, y'all had a really good recovery, because like you said, the defense was actually really playing really well today. It was a good recovery from them and they were able to tackle it. But yeah, it was a really nice pass. And he's kind of offering something slightly different, where he still has the good holding abilities, where he's our recycler, right? But just adds that little extra dimension.
Yeah, I think
go ahead. I was about to shift gears, so go ahead.
Fit in perfectly into the team, because I think that was one thing that y'all could just, like, another added addition of going forward is just long balls. And there wasn't really, Odegaard kind of came with it. Why are you?
I'm just programmed.
I didn't even pause. Anyway, like the Odegaard, like Odegaard can, but like he's much more useful like playing that advanced eight versus like Jorginho. If you let him like be the second, get in that second half of the attack, or just play the long ball over the top. Why are you like this?
I knew it was coming.
Anyway, Jorginho fit it well. Long balls are cool.
Yeah. I was talking to my dad actually, and he was basically like, we were talking about Arteta, and he's like, do you think his specialty is working with young players, and that's why we've had success? And I was like, partially yes, but like if you look at the team, he's completely changed Xhaka. Xhaka is like a new player. We've brought in Jorginho, he's fantastic. We brought in Trossard, who's not necessarily old, but he's not young. And he's added dimensions to the game. So I didn't have a point to that, but that was a conversation I was having.
Maybe just using players to their finding player strengths and then using them.
Yeah. I did have one final thing. It was a really nice gesture. So yesterday was the, I believe, the 1 year anniversary. It's weird because it sounds like you're celebrating it, but 1 year anniversary Ukraine. Ukraine being invaded. And Zinchenko was made our captain for this game, and like a gesture for that, which I thought was cool in and of itself. But then Arteta was talking about it, and apparently it was actually a player-led gesture. Like Odegaard apparently came to him and was like, we all want to give Zinchenko the captain's armband for this game, blah blah blah. So
which was the armbands were the Ukraine flag too, which
yeah
I genuinely think he is a good leader at Yale's club to begin with. So I think just having him as the captain makes like an even larger difference, especially for that day.
Yeah.
He is someone that like, he's a little bit like, I don't really have a good comparison. He's someone that if he plays for your club, you love him. And if he doesn't, you hate him because he's a shithouse. Yeah. And so I think that kind of thing makes for a good captain too, because I'm sure he's someone who galvanizes the group, and especially given the emotional kind of connection there is here, you know, he's probably someone that they can rally around quite a bit. So the thing I was going to say earlier is, Reese, I wanted to talk about that. It obviously didn't matter much in the end, but the disallowed goal, not the offside one, because that's whatever, but the goalkeeper Ben White one. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's more of just a frustrating thing for me, because at the end of the day, like, yeah, he's holding his arm. I think in that scenario, the goalkeeper's being impeded. And I also want to preface by saying, I don't think just because a decision is made originally and it's wrong, it doesn't mean you have to keep making the wrong decision. You can change your mind and make the right one, which is what happened. It's just annoying because it feels like it's always against us, where Ramsdale is never given the benefit of the doubt. And then everyone else is, because like I can think of multiple examples. For one, remember that it was against Tottenham against Everton. Pickford is kind of like thrown into his own goal, and the goal stood.
I actually do not know what you're talking about, but I believe you.
I can think about one on Ramsdale. It was when we mentioned it on the podcast a couple weeks ago. The Douglas Luiz, his direct corner and goal. The reason it went in is because Ramsdale was being rugby tackled in the box, like literally grabbed and tugged, like he could not move. Textbook the definition of goalkeeper being impeded, and it was allowed to stand. So it just feels like in a lot of these types of decisions, we've never really got, like, we are the catalyst for it being made correct, and it's just annoying. But it is the right decision.
Well, you say that, but I've watched it a bunch of times, because whenever someone texted about it, I think, or someone
I did
sent something, and I was looking at it, and like I've looked at it so many times, and I still can't actually see him holding him. I'm gonna be honest, like I still can't really. I don't think I kind of think it should have stood, but maybe I'm just missing something. But I don't.
It looked to me like he's holding him, and there's a couple different things, like. One of Leicester's players actually also had a hand in there, which could have been influencing things. Also, Ben White lets go, and Denny Ward keeps his arm there. towards the end, but for a majority of that play, it looked like he was holding his arm. So I was fine with it being disallowed just on the basis of the rules. It was just more of a consistency thing that annoyed me.
I think the Saka no call for the penalty was...
Yeah, the penalty I thought was for sure a pen. I don't know.
No, I actually don't know what you're talking about, so describe it to me.
I believe it was Susar was just kind of running behind him, and
yeah, but
it's completely accidental, but it doesn't matter. He just kind of trips on himself and then like totally just kicks Saka in the back of the leg as he's falling, and then Saka falls and nothing was given. And they like barely looked at it either. I don't know. I think it was on maybe on the basis of intentional and whatever, and the ball wasn't even really being played into Saka, but it shouldn't really matter. I don't know.
Yeah, I wouldn't have been upset if it was a penalty, but like I was also like, okay, I understand where they're coming from.
Yeah.
All right, let's move along. It is worth pointing out that City did the job that they needed to do and got the win against Bournemouth to keep the pressure on. Although Arsenal, of course, do have a game in hand, which is going to get fulfilled this week against Everton on Wednesday. So after that, I think, provided any extraneous circumstances, I think it'll be even games played going into the run-in. So it'll be easier to get a grip on where both teams are relatively, you know, because I think whenever there's disparity in games played, it's always a little bit difficult to judge who's kind of has the advantage.
I'm definitely happy it's getting resolved because, I mean, at least right now we're ahead without the game, which is nice. But like when we were behind on goal difference with a game in hand, it was like you said earlier, you'd rather have the points than the game in hand. So I'm glad that's going to get resolved this week.
All right. We will, if anything absolutely extraordinary happens in that game against Everton, we will, of course, touch base on it. But I am sort of resigned to it being a routine win for Arsenal, especially considering it's at home.
Yeah, I mean, our record against them at Goodison is not great recently. Our record against them at home forever has been great. So I don't want to jinx it. I'll knock on my desk right now, but I'm feeling good about it.
So, Ethan, at the expense of you possibly sounding like a broken record, let's ignore the lineup changes unless you want to rant more about it, in which case you're more than welcome to. But
I'll mention it briefly. I want to know, I mean, so many Palace fans are thinking the same thing, and why does he keep doing this? That I want to fly over to London, go to Vieira's press conference and ask him directly, because I feel like I'll never get the answer, because apparently no one wants to ask him about why Eze, who scored in the Brentford game, is not starting, but Schlupp is. Anyway, I talk about that so much, I'm not going to talk about it anymore. But when you look at this result, you'll think, I'd bite your hand off for a draw, but with Liverpool. But it's literally like, after watching the game, it's one of those performances that Liverpool put out to where we probably should have beat them. And I feel like if we had a more well set up team, then we probably would have beat them. But it's not what happened. I'm not too disappointed because obviously, you know, Liverpool are a decent team. I know they've struggled a bit this season, but they still have got signs of their greatness. So I'll take the draw. And, you know, they committed a lot of mistakes. And I think a lot of it was left over from the Real Madrid game during the week. So I am happy with the point, but when you think about it, we probably should have had a chance. Mateta again started, and he had two chances where he could have scored, but he sent it wide and hit the crossbar. So I think it's about time to find something else, either play him with Edouard or not start him and give Edouard the shot. So he's run his course in terms of starting for the time being, but I did want to, you know, when you look at our recent results, you're like, they're not terrible. I don't know why you're feeling down right now, but I think it's, when you look at all of them, it's just the little mistakes. And I mean, I have mentioned before that we've had a tough, you know, run of fixtures, but like ever since we've come back from the World Cup, it's been a bit of a struggle. I mean, our first game back is a 3-0 defeat to Fulham, who are a good team, but giving up two red cards before the 60th minute is very terrible, and this is not good momentum. And then we get a win against Bournemouth, but I mean Bournemouth, and then a loss to Chelsea and Tottenham was hard. getting a point against United, which was decent, and then as well as Newcastle and then Brighton and Brentford. But like when you look at it, there are moments where it's just being sloppy and, you know, probably should have beat Brentford. But I mean, I talked about that last time. So it's a weird time. Obviously, we're still looking for our first win and we're dealing with a lot of injuries. Thankfully, we've gotten Anderson and Richards back, but we're still waiting on our talisman Zaha to get back. So we still have a few more tough fixtures. I know we got Villa next, who it would be a good game, but Watkins is on flames right now. And then I think we have City and then Arsenal. So it's going to be a tough time. But I think as soon as we get over that, we'll have Wolf back and then we'll have easier fixtures coming up. So I think it'll be a good time for him to come back.
You mentioned that Lokonga was the best player on the park.
I did. I was super impressed with him. I'm sure Reese is excited to hear that. But he was so composed on the ball. And I think he played really well with Doucouré. I think there were moments where he was given the ball, and obviously Liverpool press as much as they do, he was able to kind of like hold on to it and then turn them out and then go forward a little bit. So I think Doucouré being the midfielder to clean up, as well as Lokonga doing that as well, but then Lokonga being able to turn and go forward a little bit was a great, he had that role like locked up for this game. And I think going forward, I think that'll hopefully be the starting because he just played so well. And then hopefully we have a midfielder that's not schlepped to go along with them. So,
yeah, I've always felt he had potential as a, you know, a box to box kind of tie it, but pretty much every time he appeared for Arsenal, he had to play as a Thomas Partey replacement, which is not where his strengths lie.
Right.
So playing alongside, you know, Doucouré, who can help out with the defensive work, that's like definitely what I had envisioned from him.
Yeah. And I was also thinking about this, and I'm not just saying it because like, oh, he should come to Palace, but it's like, I wonder how like different players would be if they were in a team, like, because obviously Arsenal are more possession based now, but Palace are more of a like be tight defensively and counterattack. It's like how different players can be depending on possession. Cause like, you know, obviously I feel like he'd play differently if he was playing for Arsenal still right now, because obviously all are possession dominated. So it's, I mean, I don't have much to say about that, but it's interesting to like kind of wonder and think about.
I wanted to give a word on Liverpool quickly, and I think maybe this is one of the reasons why Lokonga was able to excel in midfield as well. The midfield trio that Liverpool deployed in this game was a combination of James Milner, Naby Keita, and Jordan Henderson, which I think might be the most immobile cement mixing midfield I've ever seen in my life. I know that they brought in Arthur Melo for depth and he immediately got injured for the entire season. But how did they not see this as a problem that they needed to address ASAP in the transfer market? I don't really understand what the plan is.
I am confused because I thought they had bought Gakpo to play in midfield. I thought he was a midfielder.
I mean, I think for the Netherlands, he played like an advanced, like the Dele Alli type role.
Yeah, but still kind of in the midfield.
Yeah.
But for Liverpool, he's been playing as a false nine.
Yeah, which is weird. Well, and also they used to do this thing like where they would have four forward players. Remember when Jota first came into the team and he was like playing as an advanced midfielder, but really it was kind of like a shadow striker at the same time. And then like, so I don't understand the logic of their decision-making as regards the midfield. I mean, Keita was brought off at halftime in favor of Harvey Elliott, which is a more mobile and attacking change, but I still just don't like, that is not a recipe for success in midfield. I appreciate the qualities that all three of them bring individually, but together, I don't think that's a viable option in the Premier League anymore.
Where is Thiago?
Injured.
He's injured, yeah. Which, again, I understand, like, they're dealing with injuries because Fabinho was injured for a while. Now I think he just was being rotated for this game.
I've heard he has been bad recently.
He did look shaky when he came on.
Then you've got Arthur, who's been injured for the entire season. Thiago, who's now injured. So I understand that they're down to the bare bones. And this is also why they've been playing Stefan Bajcetic, who is, I normally not don't awful. Have, no, he's not bad, but I was just going to say, I normally don't have trouble pronouncing people's names, but he is probably the player in the Premier League that has given me the most trouble with pronunciation.
I've heard everything under the sun.
Yeah. So
in terms of the midfield, I mean, I didn't even think, I mean, obviously they're like all, I mean, Nabikid is not that old, but like Henderson and Milner playing together, like that was like, go back in the past. But like, it was, there was just issues there. But I think the main issues for them in this game was just playing out from the back. And I mean, I had so many times Alexander-Arnold played passes that were like suicide passes to that would lead to Mateta scoring, which thank God it was Mateta shooting on goal. Because if it was someone else, like a competent striker, it'd be 5-0. But it was like Matip and Alexander-Arnold struggling to, you know, deal with the passes as they were also getting pressed a little bit.
Yeah, and Naby Keita is a weird one. I feel like he has constantly been the odd man out his entire time at Liverpool. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't ever feel like there's been a time where he's been a designated member of the team / played well, which seems really harsh. And maybe I'm wrong, Liverpool fans, if you're in the comments, let me know. But or on Twitter, at SlapcastPL, thanks for coming. But I just don't – like, he's another one of these players that they've brought in with what I assume is a view to rotate out the old guard and use him as a future replacement, but it just hasn't happened. They just can't seem to get away from this existing structure, and maybe that's why they've had such a hard time this season. Just the fact that these players are not able – not suitable replacements for the players that they're meant to be. So I don't know. Okay, unless we have any other thoughts on that, let's move right along. I'm seeing shakes of heads, so I'm moving right along. Spurs beat Chelsea for the first time since November 2018, and I could not be happier about the way it turned out, because normally in these games, whether it be at home or at Stamford Bridge, they like Chelsea turn up and Spurs don't ever have a sniff. Like, last season, we played them four times across all competitions and did not score a single goal. So normally, Chelsea just roll up and absolutely take the piss out of Spurs. And today, it was the exact opposite, because Chelsea, I think apart from a couple of incisive passes through that Forster was able to get onto pretty easily, they really had nothing going forward. I don't think they had – they did have a few shots on target, but – every single one I can think of was straight at Fraser Forster. So yeah, really, really not a lot going for them. Of course, it's worth noting that Thiago Silva did have to be replaced with an injury very early on in the game. So that's another concern for them going forward, which it's all right. I mean, they have £100 million worth of defenders on the bench that could come on and cover for him. So it's not like it's a big squad depth issue, but maybe from a leadership perspective, and someone who's played more than five appearances for Chelsea going off the boil again. So either way, I think a large part of that was due to the fact that Christian Romero had probably his best game in a Spurs shirt. I thought he was absolutely incredible. I thought he did not put a foot wrong, won almost all of his duels, put in a few absolutely bone-crushing tackles as he does. These were all clean, thankfully. But he's a player that likes to play on the borderline, and I think he maybe, hopefully going forward, has found the where that line is and stays comfortably on the underside of it, because he was absolutely phenomenal. What I want to say is, against a team that cost around 700, all the players that made appearances, around 700 million for all of them, the players that were on the pitch today, Spurs' two goal scorers cost exactly £0. So get fucked, Chelsea. That's I said that we weren't going to have this segment this week because it was Dr. Tottenham was going to step in and make everything right for Chelsea. But thankfully that is not the case, because they are dog shit. Oh my God.
Sing
so
the jingle,
bad.
Sing the jingle. I forget what the jingle was.
Well, it wasn't much. I don't know if it was,
oh,
the
it was
jingle,
just,
but
it was like the
now fans or listeners, or whoever, turn your attention to Stamford Bridge. This time it's the Tottenham Hotspur Stadium, where we will all point at this blue pile of dog shit and laugh. Dude, they're brutal.
I have to ask. Okay. I want to preface by saying I don't think the problems are entirely managerially caused. Yeah. However, Todd Bowley is not competent. At what point does he decide enough is enough and sacks Potter?
Probably at the end of the season.
Oh, I was going to say, I'd be surprised if he was still Chelsea manager on Tuesday. I really would not be surprised if before this episode goes up, there's a statement that says we've parted ways with Graham Potter, which I think is dumb because, like you said, Todd Bowley's incompetent and they clearly have no idea what they're doing. But what I will say is I saw this on Twitter that remember we used to talk about Brighton, like how they would be in the bottom half of the table and we would look at them and go, oh my God, look at their XG. Their expected points are 9 million. Yeah. Like their expected points FC. The same things are happening to Chelsea, that their XG is insanely high. Expected points, they're way underperforming their expected points. Like chance creation is there. It's just their final ball, their final pass, final shot in the final third are just not clicking. And someone suggested on Twitter, it's a guy that I follow called Harry Brooks. He's a great follow. He's somebody that works with young players and he's an academy coach somewhere. I don't know. But he suggested that Potter's philosophy and buildup is too focused on trying to find the perfect goal. There's too much chance creation is too reliant on passing to the player who is in the most space, when oftentimes that's not a clearly defined thing in the Premier League because of how compact a lot of teams play defensively. So essentially what the comparison is being drawn is Potter's teams now are developing a reputation for underperforming their XG. So is that unlucky or is that a thing? Like, is that a real issue that needs to be solved? And I think there has to be some element of truth to that, because I think it is true that the buildups are maybe a little bit overly complex. And the philosophy and possession is a little bit overly complex, especially for a team that's bringing in 17 new faces, right, over the course of the season or whatever. I think that actually is the real number, 17. But I don't know. I don't know if that is a legitimate thing, but it seems to be. It seems to be the case.
To look at the other side just for a second, I don't know if this is necessarily true either, but with Brighton, a lot of the talks were like, oh, they just need like a striker. They just need a goal scorer. And they never really had that while Potter was there. And again, that Chelsea, despite buying a billion players, they have not bought a striker except for Aubameyang.
And Fofana, but he's a youngster.
Yeah, so it's like you could kind of say the same thing there again. Mm-hmm. But it seems almost silly to say the reason they're not winning is because they need to buy more players. But
they just didn't buy the right players.
Exactly, I think. Yeah.
Yeah, so I think nomination for worst player on the pitch today was 120 million pound man, Enzo Fernandez. I'm serious. He played a few good passes through midfield, but I don't think this is true, but just based on the eye test, I would be shocked if his pass completion rate was above 50%. Like the amount of times that he passed the ball straight to a Spurs player or passed it straight into touch was an unbelievable amount of times, including when he played a hospital pass to João Felix to allow him to get pickpocketed by Oliver,
the big dog,
the academy man. You probably couldn't even see the name, could you?
No,
I don't know if it was. Okay.
You sounded like you were in a cave.
The big dog, Oliver Skip, to absolutely twat one in off the underside of the bar. What a strike, son, to get his first goal for the club. I think that down at the pub, we went absolutely apeshit for that, especially because it was like he scored 15 seconds into the second half, and it was after all this absolute shenanigans that happened at the end of the first half, so we were all wound up. I'll get to that in a little bit, but tactically from Spurs, I don't know. It was just more the same, exact same team against West Ham, exact same kind of momentum. I feel like, you know, most of the things that happened were pretty much identical as far as attacking patterns and stuff like that. One thing I do want to mention, because we've been talking about Emerson Royale experiencing a renaissance, and he is, but I think I noticed something today, and then I went back and kind of mentally recalibrated to think if this was happening in the previous games, and I think it is. He's been asked to play a lot more narrow. So I think his runs are often now inverted of Kulusevski, whereas previously he would always go outside of Kulusevski. I think his runs now are actually inside of Kulusevski. And in buildup, like in the deep phases of buildup, he comes inside to make up the third man in midfield quite frequently, actually. So he'll come in and the two midfielders will shift over, and then he'll place himself in midfield and Kulusevski will shift backward to allow another sort of alternative, which, aside from playing to his strengths and not asking him to be a wide player who delivers crosses consistently, which we know he can't do, right? It also allows your defensive midfielders to be higher, or the double pivot in midfield to be higher up in buildup as well. So Højbjerg, Skip, alternatively, not always the same one, but just depending on where the phase of play is starting from, one of them will be able to arrive at the edge of the box a lot sooner than otherwise. And I think that almost solves the problem of us being outnumbered in all phases of play, is just adding that extra body into midfield. And then defensively, he just slides right back to where he would be normally, out of possession, which does potentially leave question marks for if we get caught with a fast break. That's an area that could possibly be weak to a transition. But Christian Romero's on that side, so I'm pretty comfortable with it for the moment because he's there to clean everything up. Interestingly enough, when we were taking that corner for the second goal, I literally turned to the guy next to me at the pub and I said, you know, we haven't scored from a corner in a while. And then immediately Harry Kane or Dyer wins the flick on and it basically deflects off of Kane and in. And he tackled me essentially and picked me up. So that was kind of a fun moment. But big ups to, I know I already talked about him a little bit, but I just want to give big ups to Oliver Skip, because in a situation like the one we're in, where all of our midfielders have randomly become injured and he's just been asked to step into the team and fulfill the role of Bentancur, who is basically our best player this season, except for Kane. And he's done it like as well as anyone could have asked. So huge ups to Oliver Skip. He obviously did play really well. He had a spell under Nuno and then the early days of Conte where he was a mainstay in midfield. And then obviously we signed Bentancur, signed Bissouma. He had this really prolonged injury. So he kind of fell down the pecking order. And I think people kind of forgot he was there a little bit. And then
he comes. I asked you a couple of weeks ago on the podcast, I was like, where is he?
Yeah. And,
I mean, he's kind of made his way into the team from unfortunate circumstances, but he's proven why he was a midfield mainstay for a while.
Yeah. I mean, I haven't noticed Bentancur being gone an overt amount, which I think speaks volumes to how Skip has performed, because Bentancur was lights out for most of the season. And I even texted, I think whenever Bentancur went down with that injury, I was like, we're fucked, because like he's the player that makes the system work. And Skip has honestly come in and done a very, very admirable job of holding that role down. So, okay, enough about the game itself. I do want to talk about this VAR thing, because let's forget about whether or not the incident in question is actually a red card. I just want to dissect this process a little bit, like moment by moment. So what happens at the end of the first half is Richarlison's in possession of the ball, crosses into the attacking half. Hakim Ziyech sides him down from behind. Easy, obvious yellow card, right? Referee's walking over, has the card in his hand. Then a little melee ensues. Emerson Royale comes up, gets involved, starts shoving people. People shove back, blah, blah, whatever. Standard stuff in the derby. Then Hakim Ziyech comes across, I think, to shove Emerson Royale back, but he kind of misses and he swings out and hits Emerson Royale across the face, which we know has been precedent for a red card. But again, aside from that issue, referee takes 1 million years to sort out what he's going to do. I mean, literally he took 3 minutes before he awarded any card of any type, Gives a yellow card to Emerson Royale. Fair enough. Gives a yellow card to Kai Havertz for his involvement. Waits another 2 minutes. Consults whoever's talking to him in the earpiece. I've seen reports that it was actually the fourth official and not the VAR. But he's consulting someone in his earpiece. Walks over to Hakim Ziyech and shows the red. Then immediately, like literally within seconds, goes over to the fucking whatever it's called, the review area, and watches it 1,000 times. So the process has now taken about 6 minutes in total. He's now watching the play happen on the review monitor, turns around, goes to Ziyech, who's already halfway down the tunnel, does this thing where he's like canceling out the red card, and then shows him a yellow, which is fine, except you may remember that he was about to show Ziyech a yellow for the tackle, but he never got to because of the melee. So aside from the fact that him pushing Ziyech in the face, or him punching Emerson Royale in the face, is a red card offense, he should have had two yellows on the same play because he was about to get a yellow for the tackle, and then he reviews the incident where he cancels out the red card and gives him a yellow for the incident with Emerson Royale. So I just am completely dumbfounded with how this has occurred. Like, never mind whatever refereeing precedent you want to set about hitting people in the face. The process is so broken. Like, it's getting worse. I don't understand how this process is getting worse.
I think we need like a complete redux of everything. So last Guinness Six Nations was one of the big yearly rugby competitions. And I've talked about it before. I think rugby has the best officiating because the main official has a microphone that is on 100% of the time. Like, you can literally hear him in rugby. Like, if someone is offside, they're not allowed to get into play through the next phase. So like next time they like, the guy is tackled and they like roll out and they like pass the ball backwards. If you're offsides on that tackle, you're not allowed to tackle this current play that's happening. But after, you can get involved. You can literally hear him like speaking, like, hey, no, like telling a player, like, no, you can't get through that. And like the VAR, they sit there and they put it on the giant TV screen in the stadium. There's a guy in a booth who is telling him, like, hey, I have three good angles coming at you. The second one's going to be the best angle. The first and the third are okay, but I think the second one's where it's really going to be crucial at. And you can hear him talking to the other two officials because they have linesmen just like football does. And they will talk to each other, and he'll be like, this is what I'm thinking. Do either of you have any objections to it or any other comments to it? And they go based off of that. And then the other thing is the XFL, which is a new spring semi-professional football league here. The way they're doing officiating is great. People in person, it's not as good. But like the TV broadcast, they have the XFL like officiating president who sits there and is talking with the referee who are watching the same thing. And the VP of president of officiating is going through and being like, hey, this is what needs to happen, because he is the expert on the rule. And they're talking back and forth based on what's going to happen. And that person who is sitting in the booth is telling the ref exactly, like, obviously in American football, it's a little bit different because it's like, okay, yeah, this hash, which side of the field are we starting on, what yard line? But like, they're telling them every little detail of what to do. And I think we need to move to that because they're going to get emotional just like we are during a game, because if a player's being a jackass, they are taken completely out of sanity at some points if they are acting emotionally. So if you have someone who's even in the VA, like, let's put them in a fucking box halfway up the on the halfway line of the field and have them make the decision, because they're going to be removed from any emotion. They're going to be more removed from any emotional decision than what an actual on the field referee is going to be. And I think the referee at this point is a better controller of aggression in the game than he is a controller of the actual rules of the game. I think that's where we started to dissipate what the referee's actual responsibility needs to be.
Mic up the prem refs because they don't know the rules.
I also think that's kind of true. But
teach them the rules better.
I think one of the biggest problems also that they have in the Prem. I think this is actually true of football generally, is this issue of like players crowding the ref. Like, it happens so much. And to Josh's point, these are human beings. Like, they're going to get emotional. You're going to get tied up in the moment, especially if you have like nine guys standing around you shouting whatever, you know, they're,
I mean, it happened today in the Carabao Cup.
Yeah, exactly. And I think like that's something that in most sports they don't allow. Like, so I think
like there's for in basketball, there's a technical. If football, it's another 15-yard penalty. In hockey, what is it in hockey?
It's up to the referees. Well, first of all, it's just players just don't do it because of the code, like the code thing, which is hard to explain to people that aren't hockey fans, but players just don't do it in the first place. But when they do, I mean, we saw it literally like 3 weeks ago. I don't know if you saw this, Josh, but like Sidney Crosby, like arguably the best player in the league for the last 20 years or however long he's been in the league, like was following a referee around and he threw him out of the game. Like he gave him game misconduct.
Yeah.
It's one of the league's best players. And he's like, no, you're fucking following me around. You're out of the game. Like, so I just think they've got to get a handle on this because
I know it feels like the Super Bowl had a big like referee decision.
Yeah.
Which I don't think it was the right call. And like people are like, oh, let them play. It's like, no, you can't just throw out the rules at the end of the game. That's fucking stupid. Anyway, neither here nor there. This isn't a Super Bowl podcast, but we are the only major sport that has so many discrepancies in officiating and just stupidity in officiating.
Like, and it's the sport with the simplest rules.
Yes.
It drives me nuts, except for offside, but.
Offsides and handballs is like the only complication to it. Like, other than that, almost everything else like should not be objective outside of like, okay, fouls as well. But everyone else like at least has managed bad officiating well. Like baseball just introduced the refs have never been mic'd up ever in baseball. Like they have hand signal. That's all they have to do. But there's coaches challenges now and they literally have to go on the mic and you could tell like these 60 or like 56 year old refs who have been doing it for like 20 or 30 years looked visibly uncomfortable with it, but it was for the first few months they did it, but they were making the right decisions because they have the answer to 40 to 50,000 people at least. And there's no answer to it because there's no like talking to the things, like even in the NBA, like, there's when they like go down and the video screen's right here, there's a camera pointing right at them and they can talk to the camera it's just annoying because there's no accountability for anything they're saying.
Yeah. Yeah, that's exactly right. Cause somebody in the pub today said like, they're going to have to explain this. And I literally turned around and I was like, no, they don't. Like they literally don't have to explain it. And that's the problem.
No.
Like,
and if the FA
come out in a week and be like, that was the wrong decision. And then exactly. And then it'll happen again in a week.
Yeah.
It's, like, and like, even like Formula One, like, there's literally people like that you can listen to the radio of like the principals talking to
Mikey, that was so not right.
Which I agree that one I do agree
that with one that. Was not right. Yeah,
I'm not like upset about it, but like, not the right call. Anyway, that's also not here nor there. Once again,
I always think about the Arsene Wenger quote. I'm gonna misquote it, but it was something along the lines of like, when I die, I'm going to ask where the refs get sent to so I can make sure I go to the other place.
Yeah.
So I think VAR like has the ability to be really good because it doesn't bother me if it takes long to make the decision, as long as the right decision is made, but it's done half of that. It's lengthened the decision-making and half the time it doesn't even make the right decision.
Yeah. Which is worse, like so much worse.
Yeah.
But yeah, and I think also, like, it's easy for us to say that too, but I think one of the biggest elements of VAR that we don't really get to interface with because we're in a different country is that the actual fans in the stadium. Like, today at the Spurs game, there were fans in the stadium that are just – because you know how minimal the communication is. And whenever you don't have replays like we do on TV, like, they'll just be sitting in the stands for 6 minutes not understanding what's going on. And they're seeing red cards being shown, yellow cards being shown, like – no one understands what's going on because how could you? Like, you're not allowed to show replays in the match center. So what's the, you know? And so I think for the match going fan, it just completely ruins the experience. Like, I didn't pay money to come, or they didn't pay money to come sit for 6 minutes and watch a referee suck at his job.
Yeah.
So, you know, I don't know. Anyway.
Yeah, they paid to sit for 90 minutes and watch the referee suck at his
job. Yeah, I paid for that.
Yeah. All right. Well, I think this is the infinite problem with referees, is you can talk about them until the cows come home. And I think until VAR either gets removed or we all die, we won't stop talking about it ever. So that's kind of the thing. But I think that's as good a place as any to wrap up our Premier League discussion for this week. I would now like to throw it over to Ethan for album of the week.
Okay. I don't know if I've ever done this album before, but Texas has been having a lot of different weather recently. I know recently, I think at one point it got up to like 86. So it just reminded me of the summer. And basically all I did last summer was listen to music and go work out. So this is an album that I bought during that summer, and it reminds me of the summer by Beach Fossils. It's actually an EP, so it's not a full album, but it's really cool. It's got a bunch of summer songs on it. I think it's Gold Translucent, so let me put it a little bit.
So. Ooh, la la.
Nice. But it's really cool. I recommend it if you like a good summer song.
All right, Josh, you were not here last week to do Jersey of the Week, but you are here now, so please share with us.
All right, so I have NASCAR season started last week, so Daytona 500. So I have – it's a Kyle Busch team where it was the last season that M&M's was in the as a major sponsor. They completely pulled out, paid for that like rebranding marketing, and then completely revoked their entire rebrand marketing. So there's no point that they're not NASCAR anymore, and I hate that people don't stick to their words anymore. So
I'm heartbroken that there's not an M&M's car in NASCAR anymore, dude. That's like the most classic imagery in my head from my younger days of watching NASCAR.
Me too. And there's so many good ones too, like the Coca-Cola 600, like patriotic ones where it's like red, white, and blue.
Yeah.
The Halloween ones, the Skittles. It's just the Snickers one is also great. But it's just, I was more annoyed that they took all the marketing money that they pay to have a NASCAR to go to be. I'm not annoyed by this decision. Preface it before I say it, that they were going with like the gender binary green M&M, and then they got backlash from old people. And then they were like, oh, we're going to go pay this famous actress to be our main spokes, our main marketing front now. And it's just like, okay, why didn't you stick to what you did? You had just got ups. You just caved in the other people, and it's just annoying and stupid. And whoever is the VP of marketing for Mars is probably bad at their job.
I actually just hate the talking M&Ms in general. They really get on my nerves. Like every time they come on a YouTube ad or a commercial, I'm like,
that was an envelope.
I'm like, can you? I'm like, I'm gonna lose my mind.
They made the green M&M not sex anymore.
And then I don't know if y'all saw that thing. It was like there was some protest going on somewhere. I cannot remember where. I think it might have been. I want to say Hong Kong, but I don't think that's right. But there's like a big billboard ad, and it's red M&M, and he's like looking down on the people protesting, and the caption is like,
"Yeah,
Grand Emperor Red M&M gazes on the struggle of the proletariat and smirks," or something like that.
I don't know.
It just made me laugh.
I kind of like him because I see this picture all the time, and it cracks me up. And it's like the blue. It's like the M&M bars. There's like the blue one, and he's got like some orange. I think it's like caramel, but he's got like orange on his like finger, and he's like, ooh. And then it's the orange M&M like right next to him. He's like, like he just took a bite of his comrade.
They're super nostalgic for me. Like that one Christmas one where they're like, he is real. I love that one. Every like November when it pops up because it's Christmas season, I'm just like, this is amazing.
Yeah. Okay, well, let's end the show there. I think that's a good enough place to end discussing our hatred or love for the talking M&Ms as a concept. So I have to say a few thank yous before we leave. First of all, to Josh. Thank you, Josh.
Thanks for having me. It was a good one. I think got some good points in.
And, of course, to Reese. Thanks for joining us, Reese.
Yes, thanks for hosting once again.
And Ethan, thanks for coming back on again.
Yep, it was a good episode.
And to you, the listener, thank you for sticking through all the way with us. We're glad to have you. We hope you've been enjoying these recent run of episodes. We've been enjoying making them, getting back into the groove. Kind of our new recording day on Sundays, I think, has been a good change for us. So we're getting back onto consistent uploads. And here pretty soon, we're going to have the website and YouTube channel situation figured out. So we'll keep you posted on that on Twitter and Instagram, of course. Please just keep an eye out for that. So, all right. We hope everyone is enjoying the Premier League. We hope you're staying safe, staying healthy. We love you all. And it's a goodbye from us.